My name is Javad Farid. My background is I've done a bit of stuff. First degree is computer science, which is about 20 years old, so it's effectively expired. I'm no longer relevant. My second degree is an MBA from Columbia. My third is I'm an actuary, which means that I spend a lot of time with numbers and spreadsheets. I've been doing that since I was 14 years old. I've run a risk practice since 2003 and do a lot of work with both banks and treasuries. And I do a lot of training for banking and treasury customers. The training that I run are specifically aimed at people who sell treasury products to corporate clients. And when you go out and sell a treasury product to a corporate customer, the primary objective of that corporate customer is to manage his exposure. The material that you'll see is material from my training courses, right? So that's my background. Now what I want you to do is quickly take 30 seconds or less and tell me your name and the one thing that you'd like to take away from this course. The catch is if the one thing has been mentioned before, you can't use it. So you can always pass and say, okay, this has been covered. But if you have a question that you would want answered in the next 7 days, I'd like to hear that. So how many of you have seen the movie Margin Call? Pop quiz, right? Put down some things on the board and you tell me if you've heard of them before or not. How many of you have heard of Nicholas Nassim Taleb, right? Fooled by randomness. If at the end of this course you want to learn more about the subject and you're serious about a career in risk management or something related to risk, this book is a must read. Not a mandatory requirement, only if you're interested. For both RM1 and RM2, it is mandatory for you to see Margin Call somewhere over the next 2 to 3 weeks. Now, Fooled by Randomness is a great book, but it's a book about the philosophy of risk, right? There are two books that are very relevant that you need to read. One is The End of Wall Street by Roger Lewinsky. And the second is The Big Short by Michael Lewis. And the third is Boomerang, also by Michael Lewis. Forget this course. Forget the fact that I'm a teacher. Forget the fact that you're doing an MBA from SPJN. Your specialty is finance. When you meet people, when you talk to them, when you interact with them, whether they're customers, potential customers, partners, colleagues, peers, bosses, there are certain things that you're expected to know. In the world that we live in, there was a part that was pre-2008 and there's a part that is effectively post-2008. The pre-2008 world is gone. It's never going to come back again. The post-2008 world is a very different world. For you to understand how that world operates, works, and functions, it's very important for you to read Fooled by Randomness, End of Wall Street, Big Short, and Boomerang. If you want to be successful in the field of finance, market, investments, portfolio management, risk, treasury, corporate treasury, these four books will give you enough ammunition to have an intelligent conversation about risk. So what is this course about? Traditional, conventional way of teaching risk, rather the academic way of teaching risk, is to start with this piece, value. And some of you asked me about what models do banks use. So values basically come from models. We've all done a course on valuation. So the valuation course that you've done focused on corporate valuation. With both respect to treasury and risk, you're looking at what we call model valuation. And the term and the concept that I'm going to throw at you is that there are two prices that you're likely to see. The first price that you see is known as the model price. So I have a model, it either works in Excel, runs on Solaris, it is expensive, I paid $10 million for it. This model throws out a price, which is the model's best guess, model's best estimate of what something is worth. And then there's something called a market price. So this is the model price, and this is the market price. So quick thought experiment, I have a model price that says that I have some financial instrument or security which is worth $100. This financial instrument or security is right now trading in the market at $150. So let's call this scenario A. My scenario B is the same instrument is priced by the model at $100 and the market price is $50. So the challenge that you face in risk management is that almost every single model that you work with breaks. And the only time the model works is when the model price equals the market price. But this doesn't happen automatically. This is something that you have to work at. So we use another word. We call this calibration. We calibrate the model to the market, or we mark the model to the market. Now, my question to you is, if your model is saying something's worth 100 and the market is trading it at 150, what do you think you should do? You should sell it, right? If your model is saying it's 100 and market saying 150, you should sell it, right? Similarly, your model saying it's worth 100 and the market is saying 50, what should you do, right? It's very simple. Now, the underlying assumption is that your model is right. But what if your model is wrong? What if the market is right? And there are temporary instances or scenarios when the market is in a state of shock and there is a big difference between market price and model prices. But ignoring those temporary differences, which may be because of a state of panic, which may be because of a state of unrealistic bullishness, ignoring those instances, the biggest challenge that you face is trying to figure out when the market is right, when the model is right. And occasionally, and we will see a few instances of this later on in this course, you will be standing in front of your board and your board will ask a very simple question. Will you put your neck on the line for your model? How strongly do you believe that this model is right? What is the probability, the actual chances of what your model is saying happening and occurring? And if it does, you know, how bad could things get? And if they do, what does your model recommend? What do you recommend? And when this happens, you have to take a call. Now, the biggest difference between risk managers and traders, or risk in trading, is that risk or risk managers do not like taking a call, do not like making a call, do not like putting their neck on the line. And that's the difference between the academic theoretical way of risk management and the practitioner's risk management. The focus in this course is a mix of both. We are trying to make sure that you understand the models, and we are going to focus on making sure that you understand why the models break and then how you can work around it. Some of the books that I listed earlier, especially the NNT book on Fool by Randomness, provide essential tools and frameworks that you could work with. First thing that this course is about is obviously valuation models. But then valuation is also linked to what drives prices. How do you know your model is wrong? How do you know the market is wrong? Crude oil has shuttled between low 80s to about 110 and has done this shuttling, I think, in the last 60 to 70 days. So which is the right price? $80, $110, is it $70 or $60 or $120? You cannot answer this question unless and until you understand the fundamental driver of pricing in that specific market. One of the things that we have to figure out is to figure out what are the key drivers that drive prices. And this is something that will maybe form the foundation of your analysis in the two cases that you're going to look at. You're going to look at Air Canada, where you're going to look at what is the impact of oil prices or fuel prices and profitability, and what should you do. And the second question you have to answer is GM's case, where the question is the Canadian dollar going to strengthen or weaken with respect to the US dollar, and then what should GM do. Now, the third piece that this course is about is risk. And when it comes to risk, how do you measure it? What tools do you use to measure it? How do you manage it? If you want to reduce your exposure, what products are available for you to work with? And because you're not going to run this transaction by yourself, there will be a counterparty on the other side, somebody that you would do this trade with. How much exposure are you willing to take on to different counterparties? Simple example, my name is Javad. I have a business that has exposure to, let's say, the euro, and Nikhil works for a bank, and Priyanka works for a bank, and Gautam works for a bank. My overall exposure is, let's say, about $600 million. So when it comes to hedging, should I just hedge it with Nikhil or with Priyanka or with Gautam? Or should I split it three ways? If I split it three ways, should it be 200, 200, 200? Or 100, 100, 400? Or 150, 150, 300? How do I find this out? How do I decide this? More importantly, when I say that I have this exposure, you know, I have this exposure of $600 million to the US dollar that I'm hedging to, euro to, with Nikhil, Priyanka and Gautam, if they default or he defaults, what's the maximum amount that I'm going to lose? On 600 million, if the euro plunges by another, let's say 10-15% over the next 6 months or so, which means that the exchange rate comes down to, let's say, one. On that 600 million, that's a movement of about 25%. How much of that will I have to literally put out of my pocket and put into the market? How do I calculate that? So this is the piece that's get covered in limits. So five themes: price, risk, value, products, and limits. The LTCM case is about products and risk. The bank one case is about limits and risk. The LTCM case is also about value. And the Air Canada and GM cases are about exposures. For most of us, pricing is a very one-dimensional state. What you see in front of you are prices of crude oil. Given the fact that two of the cases that we're working with are set in 2010-2011, the data set that I've used is primarily 2010-2011. So what you see here are the prices of crude oil between Jan 05 and August 2011. So on the low side, you have about $40 here, $33 here, $147 here, I think about $110, $111 here, and about $80 here. For most of us, pricing is highs and lows. Pricing is single one dimensional. You work as a trader, you work as a risk manager, you add a second dimension. The second dimension that you add is a little different. On the first graph that I showed you, I just showed you a price curve. In this graph, I am showing you two things. The time span is now compressed, so it's not the same graph. My time here starts in 2010 and ends in 2011. In the first image, it started in 2005 and ends in 2011. Right? So this is the price of crude oil. And then what you see beneath it, this blue line that goes up and down, up and down, up and down, is something that you should now be very, very familiar and comfortable with. In simple terms, simple speak, it's standard deviation. In trader and risk manager speak, it's volatility. If you take a course on standard deviation, you'll pay about $2,000 in tuition for a 7-day course. If you take a course on volatility, essentially teaching the same thing, you will pay $10,000 for a 1-day course, right? So terminology makes a big difference. So in this case, what we've done is we've plotted volatility. But what we've done is we've not plotted volatility for a single day. What we've done is we've taken a time series of 60 days and we've calculated a moving average. And this moving average is moving over a period of time. And as you can see, like prices, the moving average also has highs and lows. So in this case, the low is about 0.75% or 75 basis points. And on the high side, it's about 4.25 or 4.25. So when I say standard deviation, when I say volatility, when I say trailing volatility, and I say the trailing volatility is 4% per day, what does that mean? But when you say 4% per day, how does that translate into higher, bigger, and longer time interval? Price of crude oil right now is about, let's say, $80 per barrel. Now, when I say crude oil, I am primarily talking about something called the West Texas Intermediate, or WTI. There is another benchmark that's called Brent, which is sort of a Northern European blend. So you look at it as an outsider. When I say oil, you say oil is oil. All blends of oil are oil, right? But oil has different properties. It's sweet and sour. Sweet and sour simply refers to the amount of sulfur in the oil and the amount of refining that's required. Then there is light and there is heavy. There are different blends and each blend has its own name. WTI, West Texas Intermediate, is a lighter blend. The North Sea is a lighter blend. The Libyan crude is a sweeter blend. The Saudi Arabian Aramco blend has more sulfur. The Iranian heavy is a heavier blend. Then in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, you have two fields. You have Upper Murbam and Zakum. They also have slightly different blends. Depending on where the oil is produced, it's priced differently. From a risk point of view, from a risk management point of view, if you want to get a contract, if you want coverage, and you want to hedge that coverage, there are only two blends that are liquid, which means that you can actually trade on them without killing yourself or killing the market. And those two blends are WTI, West Texas Intermediate, and Brent. WTI produces about 425,000 barrels per day. The Saudi Aramco blend produces about 11 million barrels per day. Interesting thing is that it's this that sets the pricing for the market and not this. When it comes to risking or managing your exposure, you only have the choice of working with WTI or Brent, not with Aramco or with the Iranian heavy or with the Iraqi oil, because those contracts at this point in time are not liquid. So what we've done over there is, when I say that crude oil volatility on a daily basis, crude oil trading volatility on a daily basis is about 4%, how many trading days are there in a year? So if there are 250 trading days in a year, what's the annual volatility? How much would you expect prices to move if prices move by a standard deviation in a given year? 4% by 260? Okay. You would be right if this was return. If I said the expected annual return on oil, on crude oil prices over the next year is 4%, multiply that by 250, you would be right. That would be the expected annual return. However, we're looking at standard deviation. If I said variance, you'd still be right. So sigma is standard deviation, sigma squared is variance. If I said variance, you would still multiply it by 250 and you'd be right. But we're not looking at variance, we're looking at standard deviation. So if it's sigma squared into 250, which is the annual variance, take the square root of that to get sigma, this comes out, this stays in. So now if I say 4% and I want to calculate the one standard deviation impact over the next 12 months or so, it's going to be 4% times the square root of 250. Square root of 50 is about give or take 15. We'll just use an approximation. So I'm now saying 4% into 250 is 4% into 15, which is about 60%. That's a one standard deviation move, or one wall move, or a single wall move, or a wall move. So what I've now done is I've said 4% into square root of 250 is 15 into 4 is 60%. Price is $80. $80 into 60% is 48. So your change is 80 plus minus 48. Then gives you a range of how much? 80 minus 48 is how much? And 80 plus 48 is how much? So now you're saying one standard deviation move of oil is between 32 to 40, 128 over the next 1 year, 12 months. What's a two standard deviation move? Plus minus 96, right? First question you're trying to answer is, oil right now is at 80, how high can it go? If I'm an airline, what do I care about? I care about oil prices going up. A, because it has a direct impact on my cost structure. B, because higher oil prices, higher costs generally push the economy down, push travel down. If I'm an oil refinery, what am I concerned about? Do I care if prices go up? prices come down, right? And the reason why I care about prices come down is because as prices go up, my inventory gets marked up. As prices come down, my inventory gets marked down. When my inventory gets marked down, all of the profits that I've booked get reversed. In the long scheme of thing, everything evens out. But in a shorter term market focus point of view, my share price also comes down. Airlines, price going up. Refineries, prices coming down. Two different fears, two different exposures, two different interests. When you work either as a trader or as a risk manager, you have to learn to think in two dimensions. Not just simple one-dimensional price, but also volatility. And not just volatility. Where is volatility now? Where is it likely to go? And where will it be over the life of your trade, your transaction, or your structure? This is thinking that comes to you as you spend more and more time with this field. Because your question is, yes, I understand historically speaking, volatility has been at 0.5%. But if I'm doing a transaction, if I'm doing a trade, and this trade, during the life of this trade, volatility goes to 4%, what will be the impact of that move on my pricing, on my valuation, on my risk, on my exposure, on my capital, and on my profit? The second graph that you see here shows you the price of gold. So there are two lines. There's a blue line, there's a red line. Blue line is the actual price of gold. The red line is a simulated price of gold. You can see that the fit between the two, the actual market price and the model price, is actually quite reasonable. Would you like to buy this model? The question you have to ask yourself is that if Javad really has this model and he's so good at predicting the price of gold, whether it goes up or comes down, why is he sitting here wasting his time teaching? If I could predict the price of gold, I could also predict the price of oil or the US dollar or anything else for that matter. If I knew what the future would hold, right, why would I sit here and teach? All I would need to do, I would know tomorrow the price is going to be this, so I'm going to buy or sell. I always make money. So when you see a perfect fit, when you see a perfect model, the question you have to ask yourself is, will this fit hold in the future? Can this fit be extrapolated? Some of you have taken courses on supply chain management, some of you have taken courses on operations research, you've built queen theory, you've built simulation models, you've gone out and done forecasting, you've done regression. You've done all of these things that work for conventional, traditional, mechanical processes. But a market is a different animal. And what holds true in the market last week is not going to hold true in the market tomorrow. So model that you build on historical prices, in most cases, will diverge from its fit, from its calibration, from reality. In this specific case, the challenge with this model is that there is no broker in the world that would allow you to do a trade effective 12th June 2011 on 24th June 2012. So even if you knew where prices would be and your model did a good job of fitting it, no broker in the world would allow you to go back in the past, trade and make money on it. A broker will only allow you to trade on what we call the hard right edge. This is the hard right edge, right? Assuming this is 24th August 2011. The effectiveness of your model depends on how accurate your pricing is on 24th August 2011. Not just on 24th August 2011, but also on 24th June 2012, on 24th July 2012, on 24th August 2012. In the field of risk, there is a very unhealthy focus on building complex and complicated models with the understanding, or at least with the perception, that if I get the model right, everything else will follow. Doesn't work. So just keep this qualification in your mind. So I spoke earlier about price, spoke earlier about value. How do you figure out whether something works together or not? One of the tools that we work with on a regular basis, both in the world of risk as well as trading, is something called relative value. What you see here in front of you is you see three lines. The first line, the blue line, is the price of gold per troy ounce. The green line is how many barrels of oil can an ounce of gold. So if you see, you can see that this ratio, which is called the oil to gold ratio or the gold to WTI ratio, is at about 9 in 05 and sort of stays in about 9 till you hit 2009. And in 2009, it jumps. And it jumps from 9 to about 27, 28. And then it comes down. But when it comes down, it doesn't come down to 9. It's now trading about 17. So what relative value basically says is, if you look at historical relationships, if an ounce of gold could buy you 9 barrels of oil and suddenly an ounce of gold is buying you 29 barrels of oil, then something has to give. And it's not just with gold, you could, not just with oil, you could repeat this exercise with anything else. You know, gold and oil you can't eat. Oil at least you can consume and burn and generate power, right? But if you run the same numbers with, let's say, corn, with cotton, with rice, with sugar, with coffee, with consumables, anything that you can consume, you can get a good sense of how a specific commodity or security is faring with respect to others. You can also do the same thing with what we call the gold to silver ratio. So I've done the gold to oil ratio here, you could do gold to silver ratio. Again, the concept is there are times you ask yourself, how do I know which is right? Is the model right or the market right? Relative value is one very quick rule of thumb, one very quick tool that you can use to find out how off prices are with respect to other instruments and securities in the space that you deal with. So the question I'm asking myself is, in 2005, I could buy 10 barrels of oil for 1 ounce of gold. One of the reasons you ask this question is that generally when markets are performing well, when times are stable, you've got good proxies. So the US dollar is a good proxy of value because it's a stable store of value, right? The euro was a stable store of value. So normally you rely on those stable store of values. But when those stable store of values are no longer stable, the euro's gone to 1.58, come down to 1.07. That's the range that the euro has trended over the last, let's say, 2 years or so. Now you don't know whether the euro is worth 1, worth 1.07, worth 1.11, or worth 1.158. What do I do now? Are there any other alternate stores of value that I can look at to get an idea of where prices are, whether they are with respect to both historical norms and with respect to what they allow me to purchase? Are they too high or too low? Let's say tomorrow the world decides that the US dollar and the euro does not exist. Ignore the logistics for a second, right? And tomorrow the world decides that we will only buy and sell, purchase, trade, change, barter based on coins of gold. If you go to that model, how much would an ounce of gold buy you? Of any commodity? Of oil, of silver, of water, of coal, of sugar, of rice, of wheat, of grains, of cereals, of clothing, of textiles, or even of cars. And the concept is, unless and until something dramatically changes, you know, somehow if you find out that every barrel of oil that you consume reduces the lifespan of every single person on this earth by 5 years. So if we keep on consuming at the same rate, in 30 years we'll all be dead. Hopefully over the next 5 or 6 years you'll see a reduction in the consumption of oil. But if that's not the case, if that fundamental shift doesn't happen, right, you should see a stable relationship adjusted for consumption, adjusted for growth, adjusted for economic productivity over a period of time. All we're trying to do is we're trying to say, if I see this, I'm not saying where prices will be. All I'm saying is something, relatively speaking, overvalued or undervalued. When I look at this relationship, I at least have an opinion, and my opinion may be wrong, that compared to the period between 2005 and 2008, if I look at technology, if I look at productivity, if I look at consumption, if I look at economic growth, 2005 and 2008 are not that different from 2008 and 2011. Fundamentally speaking, there is nothing that has happened in the world, other than the world of finance, that supports a movement of the ratio from 9 to 70. And I can question this. Once I've formed this thesis that I think gold is overvalued, I can question this. I can try and find out if I can dig more information and decide whether it's relevant or not. But at least it gives me a thesis. So now what I've done is, rather than just looking at oil, I've said, okay, let me look at a currency, which is in this case the USD Swiss franc exchange rate. So if you now look at the blue line, the red line is the WTI, barrels of oil that you can buy per ounce of gold. The green line is a simulated model that's looking at something that we'll decide to talk about later. And the blue line is the exchange rate between the US dollar and the Swiss franc. And then you can extend this further by bringing more commodities into the mix. So again, these are just tools or approaches that we're introducing that we will use again and again over the next 5 or 6 days as part of our work and as part of our analysis. Next theme that we very briefly want to talk about is that each scenario that you expect to realize or see has a product that works for it. If I'm concerned about rising prices, different solution. If I'm concerned about declining prices, different solution. If I'm concerned about rising prices in a range, different solution. If I'm concerned about rising prices in an unlimited range, different solution. If I'm concerned about pricing, different solution. If I'm concerned about downside, different solution. If I'm concerned about out-of-pocket expense, different solution. Right? So I've got a handful of products here. I've got vanilla call, vanilla put, look back, knockout, knock-in, Asian, and futures. For each of these, I have a different payoff in a different scenario. I have 4 different scenarios here. And in each of them, some products consistently do well, some products consistently do bad. Which product you choose and pick is a function of both your exposure, your scenario, your expectation, and the policy you have in place with respect to hedging that exposure. All right. So we'll again briefly touch on exotics depending on how much time we have. And when you do the LTCM case, you'll find that there's a fair bit of coverage there. We'll cover that. With respect to limits, the final theme, with respect to limits, the question I have is very simple. I want to hedge $100 million. My exposure is to the euro. Let's assume for a second that the euro right now is at 1.25. In fact, let's make this 100 million euros. So the exchange rate right now is 1.25. For every euro, I will get 1.25 US dollars. So my USD exposure is 125 million US dollars. My expectation is that the euro will come down from 1.25, will come down to 1.0. Under what scenario do I care about this thing happening? What scenario would I be exposed, would want to manage this exposure? Let's say today I do a contract where I've sold 1 million barrels of oil at 100 euro per barrel. The payment for this is due in 60 days. If it stays the same, I get 125 million US dollars. If it comes down to 1.0, I get 100 million US dollars. So my risk is, if the euro comes down, the amount of dollars that I'll receive will be less. And I want to cover that risk. If the euro goes up, if it goes from 1.25 to 1.5, this will become 150 million US dollars into 3.67, right? So I'm not concerned about the euro going up when I'm receiving euros. I would be very, very happy. I don't want to hedge that risk. Concerned about the euro coming down because that will reduce the amount of actual cash that I will receive. Let's say I am ADNOC. So ADNOC has sold 1 million barrels of oil to a refinery in Poland, and the refinery in Poland has committed to pay 100 million euros in 60 days time. And what ADNOC is saying, I don't like the euro, I don't like the outlook, I don't want the exposure and the risk. I've booked 125 million US dollars, I should get 125 million US dollars. What will ADNOC do now? ADNOC will come to Hirschworks First Gulf Bank. First Gulf Bank is a bank in Abu Dhabi. And Hirsch says to them, I have 100 million euros coming in. 22nd of August, I will receive 100 million euros. I would want to sell these 100 million euros at an exchange rate of not less than 1.25. Not now, but in 60 days. So that the end of this transaction, I will have 125 million USD in my bank account. So the bank says, yes, we are good with this and we will make it happen and this deal is done. Now 60 days go through and pass by. 60 days later, for whatever reason, one of the counterparty, which in this case is, let's say, the bank, defaults and says there's a problem with the paperwork, there's a problem with the transaction, there's a problem with the trade, we can't deliver. Now, under what condition would the bank default? Would the bank default if the euro went up? Because, you know, bank is buying at 1.25, the euro's at 1.45, it'll make money, or supposedly will make money. The bank will default, or the counterparty will default if euro comes down, right? Let's say the euro's come down, not even to 1.0, it's come down to 0.8. The bank says we can't deliver. Now, when the bank says we can't deliver, what happens to ADNOC? ADNOC now has to sell 100 million euros at an exchange rate of 0.8, which means that ADNOC will now only receive 80 million US dollars while it was expecting that it would receive 120 million US dollars. When ADNOC does this, when ADNOC goes out and does this calculation, ADNOC says, my exposure to the counterparty is what? The difference between 125 and 8, which we believe, is the expected rate, the worst possible expected rate that the euro is likely to hit at this point in time. The bank is not going to default. ADNOC is not going to default because both of these are big names. First Gulf Bank is a big name, ADNOC is a big name. They are rich, they're famous, they have money, they have cash, they have liquidity, they don't have a problem. Change the scenario. We're not dealing with ADNOC, not dealing with the bank. No. My name is Javad, I have a large contract, they'll pay me 100 million euros. I'm one of the regular trading companies in the UAE. And I have Sachin as a friend who is the CFO at another trading company. And we say, listen, boss, these bankers, you know, they are all bloodsuckers. We make the money, we do the transaction, we make the profits, but they take a large chunk out of it. So let's just do a deal between ourselves. You know, I'm going to get euros, you need euros, I need dirhams. So what I'll do is, when I get the euros, I'll just give them to you and you give me the dirhams. And we've agreed on this rate of 1.25, right? So Sachin and Javad are now interacting. We've cut out the banks. We've said, we don't want to pay the fees, we don't want to pay the charges. When I get the money, I'll simply pay them to you. So now 60 days down the road, when this transaction comes in, Sachin says, you know, my boss says 125 makes sense, but 80 doesn't make sense at all. Why would I buy euros from you at 125 when the market is at 80? I don't want to buy that. And Sachin is now defaulted. Now I have an exposure. In most cases, what you just look through is you've seen that there is a chain of credit. At the highest tier, the highest level are financial institutions and banks, because they deal and interact with us, with each other on a regular basis. Then you've got high quality, high level corporate counterparties that are very stable, very sound, very secure. And then you've got further down the chain people who are more sensitive, who have more exposure to market changing. And that's where the concept of counterparty limit comes into play. Two instances we looked at, ADNOC FGB and Javad and Sachin, are both instances of what is the counterparty credit exposure. Each counterparty, both ADNOC and FGB, will assign a limit. One of the principles of risk management, supposedly academic but real principle of risk management, which is often ignored, is concentration. I don't want concentrated exposure to a counterparty. Too much concentrated exposure to a counterparty. I want exposure to many counterparties that if even one defaults, my loss is limited. So if I have 100 million euros coming in, I need to make sure that the exposure I'm taking to Sachin or to Neha or to Nevin or to Chetan, this exposure is within the limits assigned to them. And if it's beyond those limits, then I am breaching protocol, policy, and process. So five themes: price, risk, value, limits, and products. The field of risk is not just limited to risk. It's limited. It extends to, interacts with, works at the intersection of these five. If you want to get good at risk, these five themes are the themes that you have to get good at. When you apply your minds as a group to the four cases we will do in this course, I want you to think of these four themes, five. Keep them in mind. Use these themes as frameworks for asking questions and answering them. Our action plan today is volatility. Spend some more time on it. Then we will look, so we looked at some of the trends, we'll look at more trends later on. I want to do value at risk and I want to do calculating value at risk. So if I can do these four things in the next 30, 35, 40 minutes, I'm happy. I have three things. I have the price of fuel oil, I have the price of WTI, and I have the price of gold. So if you look at this series, what is the value of a unit of fuel oil? What is the value of a barrel of oil? What is the value of an ounce of gold? This is in liters, this is in barrels, this is in ounces. The objective of this session is to do three things. The first objective is to learn how to calculate volatility or standard deviation. Second is how to use that to calculate value at risk. Third is how to use that to figure out what your exposure is or should be around. Fourth question is, how do you look at correlations? How do you find out what correlations are? You've covered statistics with respect to calculating standard deviation is that most of you would simply start here and say, that's all I have to do, standard ST dev. So I'd say the standard deviation of fuel oil over the period in question in this specific case is about 68%. So this standard deviation that you've calculated, this standard deviation has a problem. Problem is that if you looked at the price changes have been phenomenal. Things go up, things come down. If you do it this way, this simply says 2.74 unit of volatility is 68 cents. Unit of volatility is $22. Unit of volatility is $242. But what happens when the price of gold comes down to 200? This becomes irrelevant. What happens when the price of fuel comes down to $10? So what we will do is we'll do a slightly different approach which allows us to preserve the relative value involved in a specific case. How do we do that? Let's start with WTI. I want you to simply take and link this and copy and paste this so that I have space to play with. We have about 3 years of data, so about 1,000 lines. So we have about 950 points of data for the dates in question. The sequence that I'm going to use is I'm going to go out and calculate a simple formula, which is what is the change in price. The change in price, the percentage change in price between 2 days, one way is you do P1 minus P0 over P0. The other way that we use in the field of risk, which is an approximation, same calculation, is we do natural log of P1 over P0. So in this specific case, this becomes ln P1 over P0. So what I've now done is I've calculated the percentage change, the relative change in the price, irrespective of the price level. And that relative change, a very small change of about 0.5%. So we're going to copy and paste this, control insert, shift insert, all the way down to the end of the series, which is here. Okay. This is my percentage return. This shows how much prices have gone up or come down on a day-to-day basis over the next 3 years. So now when I take standard deviation of this, apply the stdev function, the standard deviation that I get is relative standard deviation. So I do stdev and the number that I get is 3.03%. Now this, what is this 3.03%? This 3.03% is the daily standard deviation, the daily volatility in the price of WTI. So daily vol is 3.03%. What is my monthly vol? What's my weekly vol? How many weeks do I have? 52 weeks. So what do I need to do this? I need to scale it. How many trading days are there in a week? 5. I take this into square root of 5 and then square root of 52. If I multiply it by square root of 52, I'll get the annual vol. What about the monthly vol? How many days in a month? 22. Square root of 22. And then your yearly is square root of 250.
How many of you have heard of value at risk?
The concept of value at risk is what's the worst case loss? What's the worst that can happen? And there are many ways of looking at value at risk. One way of looking at value at risk is to say, what's the most unlikely scenario? So we say one standard deviation, we expect that as likely. One standard deviation is about maybe 66%, right? 66th percentile is 1 in 3 days. If you have a large enough data set, you should see this value once every 3 days. 99th percentile is 1 in 100 days. If you have 3 years of data, you should see how many days? 3 days in a year, and then 3 years, so 9 times. If you do 99.9 percentile, you have 1 in 1,000 days. If you have 3 years of data, you should only see it once. So the odds are 66th percentile is 1 in 3 days. You should see that, at least see 100 days of that price level, or price level or price movement. 99th percentile is 1 in 100 days. You should see at least 3 days in a full year. 99.9 percentile is 1 in 1,000 days. You should see that once in 3 years. So that's the benchmark. So one way of looking at value at risk is to calculate value at risk at these different percentiles. What's the likely movement? Once in 3 days, once in a year, and once in 3 years. So now what we'll do is we'll go out and calculate. So in Excel, again, you have a function that allows you to calculate the appropriate percentile. And that number is S and V. So we have 66th percentile, 75th percentile, 90th percentile, 99th percentile, 99.9 percentile, and then 99 point. So for this, the normal distribution factor that we'll pick up is norm S I N V. Excel has a function called norms, N-O-R-M-S I-N-V, times the percentile, gives me the factor that I'm going to multiply it with. So what I'm now going to do is, I'm going to say if I want to see this change, if I'm interested in seeing this change, here are the values, the shocks that are likely to happen. So 66th percentile, 1 in 3 days, is half of, I'm looking at daily numbers, is a price movement of 1.25%. You should see a price movement of 1.25% once every 3 days. 67 is a price movement of 2%. And if I scroll this down, that's what I see. So 1.25, 2.05, 3.89, 7.06, 9.37, and 12.94. These are the values that we would get for these percentiles. We call them confidence levels. For each of these confidence levels, this is my normal distribution factor, and this is the price shock that corresponds to this distribution factor and this percentile level. So you've all done normal distribution, right? So in the first instance, I'm saying this is 0.5. If I go on this side, I get 1. If I go on this side, I get 0. Now I'm saying, give me an instance that corresponds to about 66th percentile here, which means that there is only a 1/3 chance that I will see a number higher than 1.25%. So what is 1.25%? 1.25% is the relative price shock, saying there is only a 1/3 chance that I will see a price shock of higher than 1.25%. So if oil price is 100, there's only a 30% chance or 33% chance that you will see an price change, a daily price change of more than $1.25. Similarly, if I say give me a percentile that corresponds to 0.75, there's only a 25% chance that you will see a price shock of more than 2.05%. There's only a 10% chance that you'll see a price shock of more than 3.89%. There's only a 1% chance that you'll see a price shock of more than 7%. There's only a 0.1% chance that you'll see a price shock of more than 9%. And there is literally no chance, at least as far as this model is concerned, that you'll see a price shock of more than 13% in a given day. So now, the underlying distribution, as we are about to see, is actually not normal. So the reason I put those numbers up there is I have a count, right? My count is I have 3 years worth of data. How many data points do I have? So if I think in terms of odds, what are the odds? The odds are 1 by 2. One chance of happening, two chances of not happening. In percentage terms, it's actually 1 by 3, correct? 33%. What about here? 1 by 4. What about here? 1 by 10. What about here? 1 by 100. What about here? 1 by 1,000. What about here? 1 by 10,000. So how many days do I have? I have 938 data points. For these 938 data points, I should see 300 days of 1.25%. I should see 2 days of 2%. I should see 1 day of 3.89%. And the rest of them should be 0. Excel has a very simple tool that allows you to calculate what we call histogram. And what we will do is we'll simply take this, we'll just select this, go to data analysis. You should all have a data analysis tab in Excel. And then in data analysis, go to histogram. And if you click on histogram, in the input range, pick up the percentage returns, do chart output, click on the chart output and click on cumulative percentage. Press OK. Original assumption that we made with respect to our analysis was confidence level, number of days. Confidence level, number of days. Now let's see how does what we did earlier compare with actual data. So you come on this side where the bins are. The first bin that you were interested in seeing was you said how many days should you have at 66 percentile where you had a shock of about 1.25%. You expect to see 300 days. How many days do you actually have? Shock of more than 1.25%. And is that a positive shock or a negative shock? Positive shock. Right? Oil prices will go up by 1.25% or more. So if you take even 1.2%, 1.03% as your benchmark, greater than 1% is the sum of all of these numbers. All of these are greater than 1%. This number is actually 495, not 368 as we expected. Then you have greater than 2%. This number is a sum of, and this is 289. Then greater than 3%, greater than 4%, then greater than 7%, and so on and so forth, right? So now 7% is, and how does this compare? So you said over 9%, you should only have one instance. Over 7%, you should only have 9. Whereas in reality, over 7%, you have 23, and over 9%, you actually have 10. If you look at the shape of the distribution, look at the histogram that has been produced with the chart output, does it look normal? Maybe if you had more data, it would look a little nicer, but does it look normal? Actually, it's not. If you think about this, normal distribution has three very important attributes. The mean, mode, and median at the same point. I've removed the cumulative chart. If I put that back in, you will see that it's not exactly normal. Plus, it's skewed a bit. Very slightly, but still skewed a bit. This is 12.83. This end is 12.83 plus. This end is minus 18%. If it was symmetric, this would be 12.8, this would be 12.8. Plus it's sort of clustered or compressed in the middle. So there are three. You've done mean, you've done variance, but there are two more. One is kurtosis and the other is skewness. If you do a skewness and kurtosis score for this distribution, you'll find that it fails the normal test. Which is the reason why when you look at the numbers beneath, the number that we just calculated, so if you look at the numbers that we just calculated, you'll find that they will also fail the normality test. What you've just done is you've calculated a worst case loss. What is a worst case loss? A worst case loss has three attributes when it comes to value at risk. First is the time duration. So we did 1 week, we did 1 month, we did 1 year. Second is a confidence or a probability level. So 66 percentile, 75 percentile, 90 percentile, 99 percentile, 99.9999 percentile. What is the worst that can happen over a given time horizon at a certain confidence level? That's the definition. What you've just done in your first session here is you've calculated value at risk for WTI. I've also given you the numbers for fuel oil, which is what Air Canada would use. I've also given you the numbers for gold, which is what you could possibly look at to get a sense of where the global economy is heading. It's going up, and you can also look at the correlation between fuel oil, WTI, which is the corresponding crude oil index, as well as gold. So two questions you have to answer, there's actually more than two questions. The questions that you have to answer for both GM and Air Canada are primary questions that deal with how do you take this piece that you've just done and connect it to numbers. So if the price change in fuel oil is about $1, goes up, what does that do to Air Canada's income statement? Take the change in price and push it all the way down and figure out. Now you would obviously need to make certain assumptions. You need to make the assumptions for both Air Canada as well as for GM.